This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Vera Sachenko and I will be speaking today with Robert Bashara about his exciting recent book, Freud and Said, Contrapuntal Psychoanalysis as Liberation Praxis. The book just came out with Palgrave this winter and is a continuation of Robert Bashara's earlier work on decolonial psychoanalysis and critical Islamophobia studies. The book intervenes into very timely conversations as I would see them perhaps non-conversations between psychoanalysis, decoloniality, and Marxism. And Robert Bashara, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Vera.
Robert, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up and how you found yourself, where you are now, and especially how you discovered psychoanalysis.
Sure. So I was born and grew up in Cairo, Egypt. I immigrated to the US in around my mid-20s, mainly to pursue graduate studies. I studied film and psychology, but this, how I got into psychoanalysis, that goes back really to my undergrad years at the American University in Cairo. Mm-hmm. That's when I started to read Freud and also got into Jung. I think, you know, I'm also an artist, so I'm not just an academic. So I have a background in theater, music, and film. And this is relevant because I got really interested in psychoanalysis through the arts. Mm-hmm. So particularly surrealism. So I was, you know, back in my late teens, early 20s, I was really into like Dali, in Magritte, the surrealist painters, but I was also into surrealist films like Buñuel's work and David Lynch. And so I love that connection between surrealism and psychoanalysis, and that's really, you know, dreams, how the unconscious could be represented artistically in film and paintings, etc. So that's really my introduction to psychoanalysis. It was Freud and Jung. And then years later in my PhD program at the University of West Georgia, where I was studying critical psychology and qualitative research, I got more interested in Lacan and the sort of linguistic turn, you know, of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the shift. Where I'm based right now, I'm based in northern New Mexico. I teach here full-time at Northern New Mexico College, and it's a very interesting institution because it mainly serves underserved students in the area who are primarily Native American and Hispanic. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoy the work that I do here, and I actually got to introduce psychoanalysis to my students, and especially in relation to film studies.
Great. I think I saw on the website of the school that they advertised themselves as the most affordable college education. Yeah, that's very important work. So I wanted to ask you to start talking about the book and perhaps ask you what motivated you to write it now and to write it the way that you did.
Yeah, so as you mentioned earlier, it is a sequel to my first book, which is Decolonial Psychoanalysis. Decolonial Psychoanalysis basically was based on my dissertation. And one of the, there's some sections in there in Decolonial Psychoanalysis wherein I write about Freud in relation to Edward Said, particularly focusing on Orientalism, and Said's last book, which is Freud and the Non-European. And that section really attracted or intrigued one of my committee members, Hatem Bazian, who's a dear colleague of mine. And he told me, you should expand this. It's very interesting. And so he kind of planted the seed for me. Mm-hmm. I was already like developing those connections, but it wasn't the focus of that first book. So then I had to think about it for like a few years and kind of outline my ideas and really investigate the connection. So I decided, well, to really be fair to this topic, I have to write a whole book exploring the theoretical links between Freud and Said, which, as far as I know, hasn't been done before.
Yeah, I thought that this was one of the undeniable strengths of this book, to have this analysis of many, if not all, of Said's works and this excavation of Freud's trace in forming Said's work. And in particular, as you mentioned, the development of Orientalism as a concept, which, as we probably all know this concept in the humanities, I mean, certainly in culture studies and post-colonial studies, I wonder if it's as known as in psychoanalysis as it perhaps could be. So could you perhaps walk us through a few of the theoretical linkages between Freud and Said, and perhaps what Said takes from Freud and what he leaves with Freud, and maybe in what ways Said's work helps to decolonize Freud, if it does?
Yeah, so... So the first chapter of the book is kind of an overview of the relationship between post-colonialism as a field and psychoanalysis. So I try to do like a literature review of that relationship before I get into the theoretical links between Freud and Said, which basically are the three main body chapters, 2, 3, and 4 of the book. And basically... From my studies, I found that so Edward Said's first book is on Joseph Conrad, and it's probably his least read book because it would mainly interest Joseph Conrad scholars, right? The second one is called Beginnings, and that's the one that really you can see Said engaging with Freud's writings, particularly the interpretation of dreams, but other works as well. And so that second book, I would say, is quite underrated and overshadowed by his third book, which is Orientalism. So mm-hmm. I start the second chapter on Beginnings, sort of analyzing how Edward Said looks at Freud not just as a scientist who invents a field called psychoanalysis, but also, and more importantly, as a writer that authors psychoanalysis through his writing style. So, you know, Said is interested as a textual critic in how Freud frames psychoanalysis through the techniques of writings themselves. And what's interesting is that he noticed that the way the interpretation of dreams was written, it's almost like a dream itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it includes a lot of Freud's own dreams and analyses of other people's dreams. But Said points out that there are 8 editions of the book. So it basically is structured like a palimpsest, where there's a lot of editing and a lot of repression. So in a way, you know, whether this was Freud's intention or not, in terms of his method, there's a kind of an encounter with the unconscious through the reading that text, right? So that's a powerful statement in and of itself. And in that sense, he looks at him as a modern writer and looks at that text as a very important text for the humanities, right? Now, that has a big influence on Edward Said's thinking and his kind of theorization later on, but also his writing style in Orientalism. So that's kind of the beginning, actually, that book called Beginnings. And then the second time, I argue that Freud is repressed in Orientalism, which is Said's most famous text and the one that is considered to be the origin of postcolonialism as a field of study. Mm-hmm. Now, I argue that he is repressed because he's cited 3 times in Orientalism. Freud is cited 3 times in Orientalism. The specter or the shadow or the ghost of Freud and his theory, psychoanalysis, is very much there, right? So it's there unconsciously working through the text of Orientalism. And this is most clear in Edward Said's theorization of Orientalism, which is basically how Europeans represent what they call the Orient, right? These representations tend to be stereotypical. And basically, I think the main argument that Said makes is that Orientalism functions like a dream. It's structured like a dream, right? So you can see the influence of the interpretation of dreams there. And Orientalism itself is structured into latent Orientalism and manifest Orientalism. He actually uses that language.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? So I can say more, but I feel like you wanted to ask something here.
Actually, I wanted to ask about the latent and manifest Orientalism, because it seemed to be the one spot where you really catch Said red-handed.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to me because it's like right there in the language, but then Freud is pretty much repressed in the text.
In
favor of Foucault, yeah. And so this is kind of the conflict, I would say, the anxiety that Said is dealing with. And it's kind of a theoretical ambivalence. He likes Foucault's theory of discursive formation, and it's very useful for him. But then he ends up forgetting about or repressing psychoanalysis, but it's still there informing the text, whether he likes it or not. So the paradox that I show is that even though he sides with Foucault consciously, by repressing Freud unconsciously, he's actually affirming the importance of psychoanalysis for him, right?
But what does this really mean? I mean, what does it mean to choose Freud even unconsciously over Foucault? It has something to do with the kind of subject or the kind of what matters in analysis, right?
I think he is dissatisfied with Foucault's theorization of the subject. I think this is really the heart of the matter. So he likes the Foucault's notion of power and the relationship between power and knowledge and how he conceives of discourse, which are, of course, very important. But he doesn't like the idea that the subject is just an effect of discourse, an effect of power. Basically, Foucault's trivialization of the subject, right? And the subject of psychoanalysis, the subject of desire, appeals to him more. And so he makes the argument there in Orientalism that while he accepts the notion of discourse, he still believes in the importance of the subject. And so later on in his life, he's going to actually completely sort of let go of Foucault and return to Freud. And I show this in the text. But to go back to your question about latent Orientalism and manifest Orientalism. So in the interpretation of dreams, basically Freud shows that, you know, when we dream, when we're dreaming, which is, of course, you know, the unconscious fulfillment of a wish, and the wish is disguised, so it's always distorted, as we never directly see what we're wishing for, and that's why we need to do interpretation or analysis. But basically, Freud talks about the process of dream work, which basically translates latent dream thoughts or signifiers into manifest dream content or images, right? Mm-hmm. So the dream work does that. And so the task of the analyst, the task of the interpreter, is to go back to the latent dream thoughts. And you do this through interpretation, right? So not to be distracted by the images and try to figure, what are the images covering up in terms of what are the unconscious signifiers that are doing some work here? And so this kind of structure is operative in Orientalism, Said's text. So basically, you have latent Orientalism or signifiers about the Orient, which are covered up through the Orientalist work, functioning like the dream work, and then producing manifest Orientalism, these images and stereotypes and visual representations that we see of the Orient from the perspective of Europe, right? Mm-hmm. So the task of what I call contrapuntal interpretation, which would be Said's use of Freud, but applying it to textual criticism, is to try to figure out, well, what are these stereotypical images? What are these Orientalist images that are manifest, basically covering up in terms of how signifiers work unconsciously? So we can figure out how this works.
And here we have another transfer of the psychoanalytic ideas into kind of thinking about culture. I wanted to ask you to talk more about this, to say maybe what you find in Freud and Lacan and the Freud that you find in Said, in thinking about culture, and particularly perhaps in the import of the concept of the unconscious, which you then develop in saying that there's perhaps a double or multiple unconsciousness.
Yes.
So what is it here from the psychoanalytic discipline that we find that may be useful in culture theory and radical politics?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, they're in Freud and Lacan. So, I mean, Freud shows with his analysis of dreams and other ways of encountering the unconscious, such as free association, jokes, parapraxis, what have you, symptoms, you know, there's no way of directly encountering the unconscious, but there are ways of encountering the unconscious indirectly, right? And I think the most beautiful insight is that the unconscious is hidden in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a, because a lot of people, I think when they hear the word unconscious, they confuse it with subconscious. And I treat that kind of distinction, which Freud obviously wrote about. For him, the term was pre-conscious. So subconscious means below consciousness, which is basically related to memory, long-term memory. But unconscious is something that is outside or not consciousness, something that's very different. It has a completely different logic. And to say that it's hidden in plain sight means that it's not hidden in some kind of depth, right? So we can locate the unconscious in the very surface and form of things, whether that's subjectivity or a text, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first insight, is that when we're analyzing anything, we don't have to look for the unconscious in some kind of hidden depth. We can actually locate it in the very surface and the form of the thing that we're analyzing. So that's that. I love that insight. The second thing, and this is more from Lacan, is this notion of extimacy, which mm-hmm. Said also writes about as exteriority. And this is the notion that could also be phrased in terms of psychosocial, is that the relationship the unconscious is not something that's individual. It's something that's trans-individual. It's something that is between the subject and the big other. So that's what makes it weird. You can't locate it in one place. It's kind of in between. I love that notion because, you know, of course, Lacan said the unconscious is the discourse of the other. Those kind of linguistic structural insights are very important for me as someone that was trained in discourse analysis. And so we can locate the unconscious in the surface of things, in the form of things that we're analyzing, whether they're films, text, subjectivity, and it's also psychosocial. So it tells us something about the subject as well as the other at the same time, because of that, you know, the discourse of the other pretty much informing what the unconscious is.
Right. And there's an interesting little discussion there that you have of the differences, or maybe more the similarities, between this version of unconscious and Jung's collective unconscious, which I believe you cite. Who do you cite in saying that there's no point in talking that in saying that the unconscious is collective, because of course it's more than one person is involved, or something along these lines. I mean, the unconscious be a discourse of the other. And when we talk culture, we try at least when culture is being spoken from the kind of Lacanian field of theory, there is a strong resistance to perhaps an idea of unconscious as shared by multiple people in some way. So perhaps. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could clarify my own blunder here in addressing if there's a difference in how you pick up this concept of unconscious from Lacan, and what does Jung have to do with it? And what comes to mind for me is also an evocation from Juliet Mitchell's Psychoanalysis and Feminism, where she quotes Freud and saying that there's something like the collective mind, which is not the collective unconscious. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, I cite Fanon and Freud in their rebuttal of Jung's notion of the collective unconscious. So the question of culture for me is important, especially the question of cultural difference, which I talk about a lot in the book. I also talk about colonial difference, and I think the two are connected. So basically, to get to your question, I have to kind of get to an earlier argument, which is that psychoanalysis for me is a modern project. And because it's a modern project and a modern rhetoric, it is informed by some kind of colonial logic, right? So I show this obviously in Freud's work, but I also kind of try to trace the genealogy of this, right? Especially going back to the colonization of the Americas. So the question of culture is important because from the perspective of post-colonialism or decoloniality, non-European cultures don't seem to be included or addressed by psychoanalysis. So that's kind of like the problem, right? So my question is, how can you know, when I critique something like psychoanalysis, I critique it from a place of love, right? So you can see that I engage with psychoanalysis in the book from within the logic of psychoanalysis. But at the same time, I try to push it beyond its limit so that if it's possible, it could be expanded to become worldly, if you will. And this is a concept from Said. So that it's not just a system that's situated on modernity, but it's a system that can really work for everyone around the world. So this is kind of pushing it outside of its comfort zone. So the question of culture is important in that sense, and it's informed by that kind of colonial split. How does the question of culture relate to the unconscious? It has to do with the linguistic question, right? So we talk about the unconscious as the discourse of the other. Once we say that it's the discourse of the other, we're talking about language. I mean, how else are we going to, you know, make sense of this discourse, right?
Well, at least in Lacanese, that's, that seems to be the prime way of making sense of it.
But even for Freud, like even when we go back to the interpretation of dreams, like when he's talking about latent dream thoughts being the thing that we're interested in, so those are the signifiers, those are the words. And I also make a connection between later on, especially going to Moses and Monotheism, Freud's last book, which I think is controversial. But, you know, there's something about the aniconism or the rejection of icons and visual representation of the sacred and a kind of a preference for the word. And this is something that you see in Judaism as well as in Islam, but it's something that you also see in psychoanalysis. So it's kind of a primacy of the symbolic over the imaginary. So my point is that the cultural question is always going to be tied to the linguistic or the language question. So what languages do we associate with psychoanalysis, right? Obviously, first one will be German, right? And then you got the translations and you got the English and French, right? And maybe you can get other ones. But so it's already culturally embedded by the fact that it's German or English or French, right? Because any language is always embedded in a specific culture. And so this is the cultural question for me. It's not a Jungian question of archetypes that are shared in a mythic way. So that's not what I'm talking about. But
yeah,
I am talking about...
Yeah, I think it's important to clarify.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is that every time that we situate psychoanalysis in relation to a specific language, then we are already doing something that's cultural. And so what are the languages that are excluded? And that tells us about what cultures are also excluded.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
As you were talking, I found myself thinking about how popular psychoanalysis has become in Latin America, and of course, Spanish being a language in which so many books are written that we don't even access those people who don't speak Spanish. Actually, I don't know about you.
Yes, that's a fascinating trend, of course.
And so, of course, when you speak in the within the context of the decolonial option, which is brought by theorists and practitioners from Latin America, it's also interesting to see that there's a sort of split there. That on the that in the one hand, the psychoanalytic institution and practice is rather, as far as I know, seen as colonizing. But yeah. I do see that in your book, psychoanalysis becomes a kind of tool for decolonization and anti-racist struggle. I mean, that's certainly where
absolutely
you take it.
Yeah, and so there's kind of like a dual aim, if you will. And I write about how there's a kind of an aim of decolonizing Freud in order to theorize decolonial subjectivity. And when I say decolonize Freud, so people don't misunderstand me, it doesn't mean that I'm canceling Freud. You know, I'm very much, you know, in love with Freud and the project of psychoanalysis, but I wanted to do more than what it's intended to do.
Yeah.
That's the point of my project. And then the second part is psychoanalyze Said as a means to articulate the transmodern other or big other. And so psychoanalyze Said, of course, doesn't mean that I psychoanalyze him as a person. I'm more psychoanalyzing his texts and in relation to psychoanalysis. And how Freud returns, you know, he's repressed in Orientalism, but then how he returns in Said's last book, and which is Freud and the Non-European, and how that book deals with Freud's last book. Like, that kind of book ending is very fascinating for me, right? That kind of, and it's not something that is quite articulated by others. And there's this kind of theoretical tension between post-colonialism and psychoanalysis, which I'm trying to resolve, right? Obviously,
through the terms other and other in particular, I guess.
Especially, yeah. So, and that's why I end up saying that there are two different others, you know, and that we should be able to account for those two different others. And that's the contrapuntal move. I mean, this is, so contrapuntal is a term that is used by Edward Said and his sequel to Orientalism, Culture and Imperialism. And he develops that as a kind of reading strategy so that he can basically, and this is a term from music theory, where mm-hmm. you basically in a composition, you would have two different melodies that are doing different things at the same time. So it creates a counterpoint. And so he of course, was he loved music and he wrote about music. And so he tried to kind of be inspired by this idea from music theory and apply it to textual criticism to kind of see how you can, let's say, analyze a colonial text and also figure out some kind of decolonial dimension and dimension of liberation or resistance at the same time. So can you hold the two? And this is... and this is the point of the contrapuntal psychoanalysis, is to account for, let's say, colonial or post-colonial psychoanalysis, which I kind of group together, and that's why mm-hmm. I write post in parentheses, and a decolonial psychoanalysis. And the point is not to say that, you know, let's reject the first and just focus on the second, but thinking about the relationship between the two in a dialectical way, right? And so, and that's, this idea also is expressed in different ways by Enrique Dussel, one of the theorists that really informed my thinking. And he has a term called transmodernity, which is basically his alternative to both critical modernism, a project like the Frankfurt School, and postmodernism. And so these are basically for him two internal critiques of modernity that do not address the colonial question,
mm-hmm.
right? So what does transmodernity do? Well, he's not saying that let's reject modernity because that would be illogical, right? There are obviously many things that
maybe
are
impossible
a result of,
as well.
and maybe impossible. The point for me is how do we, get the best out of modernity and de-link it from coloniality. That's for me the key thing. And also include next to that, and this is very important, the alterity of modernity. So what modernity doesn't include, which in many cases tends to be the non-European world, non-European cultures, whether they be indigenous black cultures in the global north or the tri-continent of Latin America, Africa, and Asia, right? So there's a lot of rich traditions and practices and theories and knowledge and that shouldn't be ignored. And so we're saying Dussel is saying let's include the best of modernity and its alterity, while at the same time delinking modernity from coloniality, and that's the decolonial point. That right. Delinking.
And
so applying this to psychoanalysis, how does it look like? This is basically what I try to do.
How does it look like? Is also we have the textual evidence of how it looks like when
how does it look like in the clinic? Is that the question?
Perhaps that's where I'm leading to as well. If you have any ideas about how can it take place in the clinic? I mean, also because you call Black Lives Matter a transversal movement, and you know, my question is how do you bring Black Lives Matter with psychoanalysis? I mean, that's it's a challenge.
Yeah. So for me, the clinic. You know, one of the things I make a link between how Freud looks at repression in the clinic. He's interested in psychosocial distress. We've already established that the unconscious is psychosocial, right? It's that link between the subject and the big other. And so psychosocial distress is kind of a general term for the different kind of psychic structures that are popular in psychoanalysis, such as neurosis, psychosis, and perversion. But I'm using that as an umbrella term, right? And how these forms of distress are very much, in my opinion, linked to what I call the apparatus of racialized or racial capitalism. So I try to situate psychoanalysis within this long durée or long history of racialized capitalism, which informs, that's the context. So if psychoanalysis doesn't, you know, account for that, doesn't take that into consideration, then they're kind of operating in a vacuum, right?
Yes.
So the suffering that exists in the world, a lot of it is a function of that racialized or racial capitalism. So it's the suffering that we can talk about as racism or class struggle or sexism or all the different forms of oppression and violence. So this is what I'm interested in, the kind of context, and psychoanalysis is in that context. It's not outside of it.
Exactly.
And so it has to be able to make sense of it. And so my point is, you know, I have kind of a graph in there about the apparatus of racialized capitalism, which taking account of, you know, different forms of oppression, but there's also like a distinction between the zone of being and the zone of non-being, and who is basically human and who's not human, which is has to do with hierarchy and oppression and how that operates. And so, and that's just an analysis of how the world has unfolded, unfortunately, right? With, you know, the theft of land, the theft of bodies, slavery, all those things that still inform our world today. Right, that's kind of the kind of legacy, and so I think a much stronger psychoanalysis would be able to account for all those things, and I believe that psychoanalysis, since its inception, had liberation aspect to it, and some, you know, other scholars point to it too. It's not just me. So Patricia Gerovici or Gaston Bide or Sheldon George, right? These different theories are trying to point to these dimensions. My point is that psychoanalysis, as it exists in a kind of classical way, tends to be situated in the zone of being, right? And we have to really emphasize and give primacy to what is called the zone of non-being by Fanon. Mm-hmm. And so that's the zone that includes racialized folks, that includes the underclass, that includes what I call, you know, the lumpen proletariat, that includes all kinds of outgroup or subordinate individuals or groups in societies, right? So I call them the racialized or politicized. The politicized is kind of a term that would include people who are oppressed within any kind of hegemonic system.
Yeah.
Right. So I want to kind of think about psychoanalysis from that place. Right. This is what I try to do. Think about it from that place. And so another thinker that informs my thinking is Paulo Freire, who talked about, you know, his famous book is The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which looks at the dialectic between the oppressor and the oppressed. And his point, because a lot of times when people hear these kind of critiques, they think that, oh, we're just going to replace the oppressors with the oppressed, and that's how we shift it, right? That it's, that's what revolution means. But that's not what I talk about. I talk about that the oppressed, I mean, Freire talks about how the oppressed must lead the struggle toward collective liberation, and that that liberation process involves the humanization of both the oppressed and the oppressors. Because when the oppressors oppress, they are also dehumanizing themselves.
Yeah.
You know? And so this question is very important for psychoanalysis. This question of dehumanization and descendants of people who have been historically dehumanized and, you know, enslaved, etc. Right? Psychoanalysis has to be able to theorize that and work with that in the clinic and outside.
To hear it, yeah, as well. I mean, for me, the difficulty of thinking further with this, with which all seems very, well, very timely and very important. And as an intervention into psychoanalytic institution, I think very necessary. The challenge was in bringing this sort of anarchic impulse, you know, in conversation. How do we do this contrapuntal move of bringing an institution like the psychoanalytic institution, which exists as kind of shared responsibility between analysts and analysts and supervisors and peers and other participants in this discourse, and that sometimes becomes very elitist, or maybe most of the times becomes very elitist.
Right.
And that also has this particular asymmetry implied in its form, which is the which is created by the screen as well. I mean, the kind of projection site for the analysand. So I wanted to understand whether you're advocating for also a kind of wild analysis, or whether it has to do with reform. I mean, I know this goes beyond the book itself, but it's an opportunity.
Not wild analysis, because that's, I think, a pejorative, right? But my point is, I mean, you talk about anarchism, and I talk about anarchism at the end in terms of anarchist power, because, you know, Hannah Arendt distinguishes, you know, between power and violence, and how power is an end and violence is a means, right? So violence is instrumental. It has to be justified, and power has to be legitimate. So liberation is a process, which means it's going somewhere. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of destination. And so the destination that I try to imagine is a non-hierarchical one. And for it to be non-hierarchical means that it's anarchist, right?
Yes, yes.
Now, this is very much, in my opinion, in line with psychoanalytic theory, because the central concept of free association as a technique, but also this is a relevant phrase for anarchism.
Free association, the free, you're right.
Free association. And so another example is, of course, the famous group Das Unbehagen, which calls itself the anti-institutional institution, right? So we have to kind of, and I talk about the horizontalization of something like, you know, Lacan's discourses, right? Which are, as if you look at the four discourses, they're all premised on hierarchy, right? So is there a way to think about those relationships, but in a non-hierarchical way? Now, of course, this, you know, goes in a kind of a utopian vision.
Yes.
But it has to, because the world as it exists today is not good. It's not, you know, Freud talks about in Moses and monotheism, this is why he identifies with Moses the Egyptian, because he's very attracted to some of those ancient Egyptian principles, you know, that go back to Akhenaten and this religion of Atenism, which is supposedly the first monotheistic religion that becomes Judaism eventually. And so that principle of Maat, M-A-A-T, which is a principle of truth and justice, it's something that Freud is very attracted to. So you can see that he's not just talking about this abstractly, but he's also reflecting on the experience of the Nazi annexation of Austria and him having to escape the country with his family and his belongings and, you know, leave to the UK to survive that kind of horrible experience, right? And so this question of truth and justice, it's relevant back then, continues to be relevant, and it's a very important question for psychoanalysis, you know? And so it has to do with, as you said, asymmetry. It has to do with hierarchy. It has to do with oppression and violence.
Very endless and important, of course, deliberation. I was interested in how you framed it as a kind of analytical deformation as opposed to the Lacanian analytical formation.
Yes.
And in particular, you talk about the discourse of the analyst as a kind of decolonized social theory. Could you speak to that a little bit? Because we also have the graphs there, but
So this upsets a lot of clinicians, because when you have like non-clinicians talking about this stuff, they get really upset. But for me, you know, like the analyst, the function of the analyst is to, you know, cause the desire of the subject, the divided subject, so that they can produce, you know, new master signifiers and change the relationship with their symptoms so that they can have, you know, experience more jouissance or a different kind of jouissance, different kind of enjoyment. And so that analyst, anyone can take that position. That's my point. It doesn't have to be mm-hmm. like the typical psychoanalyst. And in fact, and that's my point, kind of inspired by Freire, is that the best person to do that is someone that experienced oppression firsthand, to function as that cause, especially because those are the same individuals that tend to be objectified in a racist way, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Fanon talks about how blacks are racialized as phobogenic objects, right? So that means that, you know, like the way that whites, especially, you know, racists, relate to blacks, there's this kind of already anxiety provoked by their perception of blacks as phobogenic objects, as objects that, you know, cause fear and anxiety, right? So they are already positioned as objects. So they are the perfect, you know, the racialized people, politicized people are the perfect people as the oppressed to lead this struggle toward collective liberation and actually function as the analyst, right?
That's so a very interesting question of course, what makes an analyst an analyst? I remember Derrida's smirk after Lacan died, in which he said, I do not believe that one is an analyst merely because they get paid.
Right.
I mean, I think that you open a very critical conversation about this, with these parallels of perhaps also the racialized other being in a space of analyst through being object A, perhaps.
Yes, yes. And I'll give you another example. So in my first book, which deals with, you know, what I call Islamophobia, Islamophilia as a fantasy, which is part of this bigger ideology that's connected with the war on terror. So I interviewed 19 U.S. Muslims about their experiences with Islamophobia, but also how they resisted. And I wanted to kind of see what kind of subjectivities are there that are resistant to, you know, the hegemonic or, you know, ideology. And so basically there's epistemic resistance or resistance through critical knowledge, which very much aligns with the hysterics discourse. So this is where the U.S. Muslims basically reject the kind of knowledge, the dominant knowledge about them and how they're being represented. And so this is something that you see also in Edward Said's sequel to Orientalism, because basically Orientalism deconstructs the European stereotypes about the Orient. But the criticism he received for that book is that, okay, you did a great job deconstructing the stereotypes, but you didn't look at all at how the Orient represents itself. So he took a long time to kind of go back to that question, and he addressed it with culture and imperialism, which is the question of self-representation. And so the second form of resistance I found was ontic resistance, what I call ontic resistance, which is resistance through being. And so these US Muslims, just by the fact that they are Muslims in a hostile environment that's Islamophobic, that's already a form of resistance, just to occupy space and time, right? And in that kind of ontic resistance, they function as an objet A, right? Like if it's a woman wearing the veil or the hijab, right? Or if it's a man with a beard, right? So they're causing the desire and they're causing anxiety for the other. It's uncomfortable, right, for the racist subject, but it's important if we're going to, live in a kind of pluriversal world, right?
So, in conclusion, I wanted to ask you, Robert, about the distinction you introduce between various kinds of pleasure, which is an intervention into perhaps Lacanian understanding of masculine and feminine jouissance with the concepts of divine pleasure, and particularly in contrast to the pleasure of freedom offered by liberal society. So if you could speak about this and how it comes into under the framework of your project on fundamental psychoanalysis.
Okay, so basically, Lacan talks about sexual difference or sexuation, or the difference between phallic or masculine jouissance and feminine or other jouissance, and how there is no rapport between the two. For me, that kind of theorization applies specifically to the zone of being. So those who are privileged basically within the apparatus of racial capitalism, but I don't think it applies as much to those who have been historically racialized, enslaved, not even gendered. So, I mean, the slave was not even considered human. It was property. It was an object. It was a thing. So we need a different theorization for the descendants of those in the zone of non-being, or those who continue to be in the zone of non-being because they're in the underclass. And so I introduced this conception of colonial difference. And within that, you have two modes of jouissance. You have mythical jouissance, which is the kind of jouissance that is based on oppression and violence. So the kind of jouissance that would support the apparatus of racialized capitalism to continue to exist as it is. So without questioning it, without making any major changes or revolutionary changes. And the other kind of jouissance that is there from the zone of non-being is divine jouissance, which is a jouissance related to liberation. Collective liberation, as opposed to individualistic freedom, my freedom versus yours, collective liberation of everyone, but led by the oppressed, led by those who are in the zone of non-being, and also divine violence. So, of course, that distinction comes from Walter Benjamin, and it's rooted in Jewish mysticism, but he does give a concrete example in Critique of Violence, divine violence, because it's a very debated concept. But he talks about the general proletarian or revolutionary strike, which is different from the kind of strike of that is just about raising, the minimum wage or something like that, that has kind of a short-term goal. For him, the general strike has the goal of completely dismantling the system, right? So imagine if there's a general strike that continues for more than one day, you know the effect of that on the whole economy. It's major. And it could be revolutionary. And of course, he does ascribe to anarchism as well. This kind of divine violence, you can think about it also in terms of the indigenous cultures, especially in the Americas, that have been repressed, oppressed in terms of, their rituals and practices, which are inherently, in many cases, spiritual and sacred. And that connection is also there in Freud when he identifies with the Egyptian Moses, and especially the principle of Maat, the principle of truth and justice. That kind of spiritual dimension is important. It's also there with the Black spirituals, which provided a connection for enslaved Africans with African traditions and religions. And it was a reminder for them, you can say, to use Freud's term, an archaic inheritance, right? Something that links them together and to remind them of their humanity in the face of, the horrible experience of being abducted and enslaved and being forced to work, for nothing, and face death and violence and mutilation and rape and all of that. So we shouldn't shy away from that kind of spiritual dimension that has a kind of intellectual aspect too. It's in Freud, it's in Benjamin, but it's in other traditions as well.
Well, Robert, I have so many questions left. We could do another hour, but we've taken a lot of your time already.
No worries. So. I know I didn't get to a lot of things in the book, but that, I hope the reader, the listener, they get the book so they can see this a lot more than what I talked about.
And perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now, if you have a project for a book or activism.
Yeah, so I actually have a translation that should be coming out pretty soon. It's a translation of an Egyptian book of philosophy from the mid-90s by Egyptian philosopher Murad Wahba. And it's called Fundamentalism and Secularization. And so I translated it from Arabic to English. That should be coming out pretty soon. And I'm really excited about it because not many people in Euro-America know about Murad Wahba. And part of my project is, of decoloniality, is to introduce, thinkers from the global south that are doing important work but are not known, in the global north just because of the language barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting project. I wanted to thank you for being on the show today, and it was a great pleasure to speak to you.
My pleasure is all mine. I thank you so much for your thoughtful questions.